The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Thursdays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.com. Every week at this time, we chew over the news, we dissect a couple of stories, we meet some great guests, we hear from you when you can call us at 888-874-4888. That number again, it's free. 888-874-4888. We're talking about what's going on in our world and what isn't going on in our world, what should be going on in our world. So that's the challenge we have every week. This program is also available as a podcast by the end of the day on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website, so you can download it as well and share it with your friends. We have some great guests today. Justin Krebs is going to be joining us, the Dissectress. Sherry Welch will be here, and also Aaron Crown from Atlanta, who runs the ML-Implode website monitoring the economic collapse that seems to be underway. Stay tuned for all of that here on PRN.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo.
Justin Krebs, what do you think of my theme song?
I love it. I love it. I think our movement is lacking in songs we can all rally around and sing together.
That's right. We need some singing liberally. And let me tell you about Justin, who's just joining us on the phone here. Here's what Sherry wrote to me. He says, like many liberals in the Bush years, Justin Krebs needed a drink. So he and his friends started drinking liberally, getting together in a bar to talk politics. One liberal told another who told another, and soon Americans everywhere were taking part. Living liberally now incorporates eating liberally meals, screening liberally films, laughing liberally comedy, reading liberally book clubs around the country. In 300 communities, more than 50,000 proud liberals have now found their political home, and I hope that this program can join that home, because I really have a great deal of admiration for what you're doing. Tell us a little bit more. What motivated you to launch this effort, and how does it actually work?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, let me say that I'm happy to be here. You're all definitely already part of our community of networks and proud liberals. I have a feeling we'll be talking liberally over the next few minutes today. We started drinking liberally not because we were starting a movement or starting a national organization, but because, quite honestly, we needed a drink. It began in the spring of 2003, a time that you remember and many of your listeners remember and your readers remember. It was a pretty dismal time to be voicing a progressive point of view.
We were beginning to, in that period, for those who don't remember, you know, we were liberating Iraq. We were promoting Iraqi freedom. You know, we were involved in all of the things that the world remembers with such fondness today.
And sure enough, seven and a half years later, President Obama is following in President Bush's footsteps and declaring that we've liberated Iraq. And yet it goes on. But what we didn't have in 2003 was a sense that there were progressive voices effectively speaking out. There were terrific people and terrific activists and filmmakers and radio hosts, but we felt ungrounded. And those of us in New York City said, well, how can we even begin a discussion with the rest of the country when our own friends aren't talking politics? Our own friends who agree with us about the war, about the Patriot Act, about the administration, they're not engaged.
It's so true, Justin. You know, we've become sort of atomized in a way. Partly it's, you know, the internet. You know, you become addicted to your email and to your texting and to your Facebook account and your Twittering and all the rest of it. And so rather than actually connect with a fellow human being, you're like in this virtual world all the time, you know, firing, you know, words, shorter and shorter sentences out into the blogosphere or the you know, information stratosphere, but you're not really getting the kind of real-time feedback and camaraderie that helps build political movements.
The camaraderie that, you know, and when you asked me how I liked your song, it was only half a joke that we should have all have songs we can sing together. Camaraderie is built through these shared experiences and shared culture. The unions who used to have songs that they would all sing together, the activists who have had the experience of working together or living together, and we're now just giving people the chance to drink together. And it's a small step towards rebuilding that sense that you are part of a liberal tribe.
One small step for men. No, but you know, Justin, I really like this initiative for a couple of reasons. One, it's so simple. It's not, you know, pretentious. It's not complicated. You don't have to sign on the dotted line. But you do kind of show up, and you do interact with people. And you do, hopefully, as a result of that, get inspired or motivated to do more than you would ordinarily do sitting at home tied into your iPhone. And, I think that's part of what we've lost here, why the right seems to have much more of a capacity for action these days, and anger, I think, is tied into that they're not as encapsulated, you know, in this same sort of world that does have a way of desensitizing you, even though you may be better informed, you may have more access to more sources of information, but you don't have something else, you know, that personal touch. And, you know, this is what, like, for example, phone trees used to give you. You would call 10 people, and they would call 10 people, and you know, there was some sort of vibrant, interacting community. Now there seems to be a lot less of that, and, you know, two-hour shame, because although a lot of people are sitting around stewing and angry and upset about what's happening to our country, the response has been kind of tepid, you know, kind of wimpy in a way.
The good news is that there are more and more groups that are getting people face-to-face on our side. You know, Move On over the past few years has started these local councils. The people weren't just being part of an email list and weren't just donating to an online group, but they were actually starting to meet other Move On.
Yeah, I can actually confirm that from my own personal experience. I've just been invited to come up to the Bronx to a Move On event, but I went to Jersey City. It's oh so pretty, you know, and there in the church on one of the hottest days of my life, you know, mm-hmm. a group of people were in the basement talking about, you know, campaign finance reform, hearing me give my spiel about my movie Plunder and about the issues of the crimes of Wall Street. It was really an excellent discussion, and the people were very diverse in their backgrounds and in their interests. And, you know, and I was very taken with it. And there was a kind of honesty there. There weren't people kind of posturing with rhetoric and, you know, slogans and all the rest of it, but people really talking from their hearts. And I think that's what we need. If we can build that kind of a network, it'll help a lot. By the way, joining us on the line is somebody who's really taught me more about leading with my heart, you know, if I might say, my faltering, you know, system here inside. Sherry Welsh, Justin, you met her in Las Vegas, I believe, at the Netroots Nation conference. Is that true?
I can't tell you, because what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Okay.
But I will say yes. Sherry and I met at this blogger conference, Netroots Nation, bringing together filmmakers in the type of community that you were just describing, people in a room sharing ideas. I do like your description of the place in Jersey City. We're always in basements. Why is it the left always decides to meet in basements? Do you really take this underground thing seriously?
Right. Well, maybe if we started meeting in subway stations, we'd get a bigger turnout, you know? But, you know, anyway, I just was mentioning Sherry to you only to say that Sherry and I have been working together for a while now. You know, we're in constant touch, and she's done so much to really invigorate my own work, my blog on mediachannel.org, and scolding me when I need to be scolded. But I've never met her. I mean, literally, we have yet to meet. So we have this. It is possible to have a kind of virtual relationship in which people really work closely together. So I don't want to be totally dismissive of that, but I like the spirit of this. So tell me about, like, what is a Drinking Liberally event like? What
sure.
happens? Yeah.
Tonight, for example, we meet every Thursday night at a bar in Hell's Kitchen, west side of Manhattan. It's where we started, a bar called Rudy's. From 7:30 on, people will come and go very informally. And as soon as you walk in for the first time and you find our booth, someone's going to offer you a beer. It's just a sign of welcome, and chances are that the first time that person walked in, they got offered a beer. And you'll have informal, freewheeling conversation.
So this isn't really a beer summit, you know, in a classic sense, you know, with a servant serving the beer. But this is really people getting together and hanging out.
Promoting democracy one pint at a time,
okay.
Right there.
There you go.
And the people there tonight will range in age. Some of them will be very politically active. Some will be more politically curious. They maybe read some blogs, watch Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann or Ed Schultz, and aren't involved yet. And this is a way that they can start interacting with other folks, fleshing out their ideas, feeling like they're part of a positive community. And hopefully it leads them to more activism, more involvement, seeing films, going to local meetings of Move On, joining candidate campaigns. And this is happening all over the country. We meet at Rudy's on 9th Avenue every Thursday night, but as I tour around with my book that's just come out, I've visited 25 different Drinking Liberally chapters over the last 2 months, and I'm on my way to about 25 more over the next 2 months. And these are great, welcoming groups everywhere you go.
Well, you know, I don't know if I can get there tonight. I'd sort of like to. My brother's in town, so that may not be possible. But, you know, it's really good to know about, and it's something I think that is easy to replicate wherever and whenever people can find a way of getting together. Now, Sherry, you met this elusive Justin Krebs. What was your take on all of this?
Well, I've known about Justin since he came to Las Vegas in 2005 when they had the first Netroots, the Daily Kos' yearly meeting, when I was living in Vegas. And so I think what Justin does is amazing. And they have two groups that meet liberally to drink, to screen, to read, to eat in Las Vegas. And in fact, I'm going to one in Atlanta tonight at the Thinking Man's Tavern in Decatur. And I will be starting one in Mableton, Georgia, which is like, 9 miles from downtown, but, you know, Atlanta's a huge city. And Justin does amazing things, and he brought together all these filmmakers when we were at Netroots Nation in Las Vegas with some of the most diverse and interesting films. And I thought, what a wonderful way for filmmakers to start getting their films out, because it's so costly anymore for anybody to get a film made. And as you know, Danny, money has dried up.
Well, you know, particularly distribution is difficult for independent filmmakers like myself. I mean, I had a big breakthrough a few years back with my film WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception. I got into two theaters in New York for a two-week run. How exciting, okay? And then I discovered, they had certain expectations of me. I had to take out advertising to promote not only my film, but the theater that the film was in. So now this cost me, at the end of the day, almost $20,000 to run ads in the New York Times. Here I am, the big critic. The whole film is a criticism of the mainstream media. Here I was funding the mainstream media and supporting, you know, these theaters and, you know, ensuring the impossibility of recouping any money from a theatrical run. So while it looks great to have your, you know, kind of film up in lights along with Cats and Dogs too. At the same time, you know, you're not going to make a dime from it. Your only hope is that having it in the theater, might get some reviews, which it usually doesn't when it's a documentary, except if Michael Moore does it or a handful of others. And so you don't even get that bounce, and then you try to get it on DVD and to try to sell and promote it on the strength of a run which itself wasn't promoted. So you're in Nowheresville. I mean, I'm now promoting my film Plunder, the Crime of Our Time on DVD. We have a website, plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. Did I just get a plug in there?
Yes.
But, it's difficult. And, you know, one of the ideas that's come up and is done in Europe, sort of interesting, is what they call the micro cinema. You know,
yes.
Small club-like environments where films are shown and discussions are held. The first time I ever saw anything like that, I was actually in Cuba in the late, at the end of the 60s, that dates me, doesn't it? And there was a film shown, I forget the name of the film, but it was about a kind of women's liberation. You know, it was a critique of the sexist bureaucrats in the Cuban government, done by a Cuban filmmaker, and shown to Cubans in Spanish, you know. But what was fascinating about it was that after the film was shown in this theater and it was packed, there was a debate about the film. People
yes.
getting up denouncing the practices, others defending the government. It was charged. It was amazing. And it went on as long as the film, okay? So it showed me, you know, that people do want to talk about these issues if they're given the opportunity to, if they're not hustled out of the theater immediately after the lights come back on, if there's some effort. And I think that's the appeal of film festivals in many cases, where directors are able to say a few words and answer a few questions, and people can interact, you know, in a film culture, which is what's missing in a film theater, okay, which is just there to sell.
So, Danny, let me ask Justin a question.
Hold on, he's going to react to that, and then you ask him a question. Go ahead.
I was going to say, that is one of the features of screening liberally. If we can get the filmmaker there, that's terrific. But if not, I've seen short films, 20 to 30 minutes, say, which you would never pay $10 to go see that in a movie theater. I've seen people come for a 20, 30-minute film and then have an hour discussion after it.
Yeah. Justin, try 12:50, okay? In my neighborhood, anyway. And you know, it was very funny because I was actually quoted in the Daily News with my picture and all this, you know, denouncing the increase in movie ticket prices to $6.50 some years back. And now it's up to $12.50, you know, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. But, you know, I think you're absolutely right. People want to participate. That's why social media is so effective. They want to take part and not simply be a passive recipient of information. Sherry, you were saying before you were so rudely
interrupted.
Yes.
Justin, you have been traveling across the nation. And I'd like to know what is happening in the Midwest, which was what are people saying about midterm, the policies, et cetera, et cetera. Could you just enlighten us?
Absolutely. As Sherry mentioned, I've been on the road, so I just came back from Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Covington, Kentucky, Minneapolis. People, the local liberals everywhere, are absolutely tuned into what's going on in these elections. The question that it seems like the mainstream, the sort of major traditional media and the pundits want to ask is, do they like Obama or not? But the fact is, on the local level, people are in a much more nuanced position. They're frustrated that the Obama administration hasn't done more. Some feel like he's hemmed in by a conservative Senate. Some feel like he's a disappointment. But the fact is, no one is saying this is only about a presidential election. They're looking at midterm elections, but they're also looking at local elections. They're looking at very local legislative issues, transportation issues, housing issues, community development issues. And it's interesting that even when the pundits that we all try to stop listening to so much say, oh, well, the left is demoralized, no, the left has a complicated feeling towards our president and towards the nature of presidential power, but the liberals I'm meeting everywhere are energized, are active in their local meetings, they're going to church basements, like Danny mentioned, they're seeing films like Plunder, they're getting involved in pretty heated primaries that you don't even hear about on state assembly and state senate legislative levels. So the fact is that there is a liberal base out there, and that when you do get an elected official like, say, an Alan Grayson, who's from Florida, the congressman who speaks out so forcefully, people really flock to him. or a television host like Rachel Maddow. People flock to her. But they also are doing it locally without needing to be told on a presidential level, here's where the left is. These people are doing it on their own.
I'm so happy to hear that, in part because I felt like we were all caught up in this fundamentally flawed belief somehow. You know, power is in the White House. Whoever has the White House has, quote, power, and that's how America operates. You know, as if politicians are the people who are really calling the shots, you know, in a society that's dominated by corporations, that's dominated by private sector power, by military industrial power, by intelligence agencies, by, you know, politicians who have been bought and sold and these days are just rented, you know, for various votes. You know, our view of things is so superficial. It goes back to, like, elementary school. You know, we have three branches of government and there's checks and balances and all of this. When in the real world, you have lobbyists, you have, you know, all sorts of pressure in politics that are really dominating politics. And that's why we need to update also our view of all of this. And I think this notion of being able to work at the state, local level is important. And also to be able to pay a little more respect to the NGO organizations, the various groups that are really specializing in a lot of issues, including economic issues, and who have a lot to teach us. And we can't just rely on mainstream media outlets to keep us up to date. We have to seek out more diverse sources of information. At least that's my mantra right now.
If the banks, those banksters that keep robbing us change their behavior, it's more likely going to be because of localized action that is taking place around the country in the face of the banks, boycotts and strikes and mortgage issues, and than it is that it's going to come from the president, who might have the best intentions, but still is tied with a network of people who believe that the banks are fundamentally right.
See,
and we see that local action taking place.
See, even there, I mean, again, there's sort of an objective reality, which often kind of, you know, the perception reality doesn't really catch up with, you know, namely, you know, that the banks, the financial sector, used to be like 6% of the economy. You know, now it's almost 60% of the economy. So you have this process of financialization where financial institutions are really so dominant. And you know, and they're dominant not just in banking, but in the whole society. They're the ones who are, in a sense, providing the money for the lobbying. And you'll notice that a lot of the Wall Street firms are now shifting their money from Democrats to Republicans because they don't even want, you know, any regulation, even though the rules that have been passed so far seem to be ones they can more than live with.
Can I tell you one funny story about banks?
Yeah, go ahead.
One funny story about banks from the road, which is in my book, 538 Ways to Live, Work, and Play Like a Liberal, I suggest all sorts of ways that you can bring your progressive values into your everyday life, how you spend money, how you consume entertainment, how you get the news, how you interact with neighbors and such. But whenever I speak about the book at these Drinking Liberally chapters, I always make a point to say that I don't actually do all 538 of these things. It would be overwhelming, it'd be too much, that all of us have some flaws. And my fatal flaw is I am still a Bank of America customer. I have gotten booed at my own events when I admit that I'm still a Bank of America customer. And honestly, I should switch to a credit union or a community bank, and I just haven't yet. But it is a reminder that the banks have, these major banks, not only are all over our government, they're all over our personal lives, even we're caught up in them. But there is this anti-Bank of America energy out there that gets people hissing me at my own book talks.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, these are the contradictions that we live in, you know. We need institutions that, you know, are convenient to us, you know. Since we're in the confessional mode here today, I mean, I'm the big bank critic here, but, you know, I bank at J.P. Morgan Chase, but not because of Jamie Dimon. Not because of Jamie Dimon, the CEO, but because of Andrea S. I won't give you her last name on the air, but who is, you know, a woman who's worked in that bank, who's been very nice to me, who's been very helpful to me, who's taken all kinds of efforts to keep me up to date with what's going on and my own, how to access my accounts and all of that stuff. And, you know, so in a way, what we also have to learn, I think, from the private sector, if you will, is this idea of customer service, this idea of being attentive to the needs of the people that we work with. And I find that, you know, on the left and on the right, there's a tendency not to do that. We don't really try to help people out. I mean, I've been talking about this group, NACA, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, you know.
Yes.
I was down in Atlanta with them. What are they doing? They are helping individuals who are about to lose their homes to stay in their homes. They help them fill out the forms, come up with a budget, practical things that people need, and they're providing that assistance in the same way as, you know, in years gone by, the Black Panthers ran the breakfast program for kids who couldn't afford to have breakfast, and they provided breakfast. You know, these sorts of services are part of political organizing, part of political outreach. And we have to realize that not everybody is as knowledgeable about various things as some of us may or may not be, okay? And we need to find ways to help them with these kinds of skills. Now, Justin, 538 ideas. Who published this book? How do people get hold of it, for one thing?
Absolutely. 538 Ways to Live, Work, and Play Like a Liberal. You can find it at all the online book retailers that you prefer to use. You can learn more about it at justinkrebs.com. It's available in some bookstores. It was put out by Skyhorse Publishing, which is based right in the West 30s. They're a great New York-based group, very eclectic tastes and flavors in books, but they believed in a book by a no-name, no-experienced author, so you got to give them credit for that. And
Your title reminds me of something which will also define my era for you, Justin. I hope this doesn't take me off your bus, but you know, back in the day, as we used to say, or we still say, the Vietnam War, there was a book by the late Tully Kupferberg, poet, friend of Allen Ginsberg, actually written about in the poem Howl. There's a movie coming out about Allen Ginsberg, which I'm looking forward to seeing, called Howl. And Tully wrote a book, you know, 1001 Ways to Resist the Draft, okay? And one of his ways, which struck me at the time as being rather interesting, march on your draft board with 42 friends dressed in North Vietnamese uniforms. He said, that'll get you out of the draft. Okay. Justin Krebs, stay with us, okay? Cherry, you were going to make some comment here.
I was going to ask him, he was in Ohio. What is the tone and the tenor of being able to replace Boehner in Ohio in the 8th District with the fabulous Justin Kaluuya? Is that how you say his name?
I will be honest that I didn't hear much about that race. The part of Ohio that I was in Cincinnati is where there is a pretty conservative Democrat named Driehaus in his first term, and he's beleaguered. But right now, a lot of the liberals there are not thrilled with him. He's been sending out notices, proudly saying that he's done everything to prevent abortion rights that he could. And there are a lot of liberals there say, you know what, we have other races we can focus on rather than helping this guy Driehaus win re-election.
Yeah, well, this reminds me of that race in Connecticut, okay, where Ned Lamont, who had been the big, you know, poster boy of progressivism when he ran against Joe Lieberman, and a lot of people raised money for his campaign and supported his campaign because they detested and still detest Joe Lieberman so much. You know, he turned around and running for governor in Connecticut basically abandoned all of his progressive principles. He's a multimillionaire. He had plenty of money for his campaign. And then he went down in flames because the people didn't come out to support him the way they did before. So the warning there is for Democrats who are going to abandon principles and are going to pander to constituencies in the belief, you know, somehow that people will think of them better if they know they, you know, support this or that issue, they're likely to be very disappointed on election day when people basically stay away from the polls or stay away from their campaigns. And this is another lesson learned in a way, I think. Listen, I want to continue this conversation. If you can hang with us for a few more minutes, Justin, we'd like to know. We've only gotten to about 412 of your ideas. We have more to do here, but I want to hear more about that. I want to to talk about Credo, the phone company that you've been involved with, and I want to hear more about your other work at The Tank, a nonprofit venue for performing arts and public affairs here in Manhattan. So there's a lot more to talk about. Stick with us for more of Justin Krebs, Sherry Welch, and later joining us from Atlanta, Aaron Crown.
Shiny new credit card. Don't fret if your funds are low. You can use it wherever you go. Whenever you do, your debts will accrue and give us a happy glow.
It's so fantastic.
Fantastic.
When you pay with plastic. With plastic.
Wait for our bill to come. Just pay the minimum. The interest will grow on the money you owe and make it a tidy sum.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Orly Cotell with Sierra Club Radio. Tune in Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to hear interviews with green authors, activists, politicians, celebrities, and more.
Houston, we have a problem.
Hi, I'm Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
Stephen Lindman hosts the Progressive Radio News Hour, Saturdays and Sundays, as well as currently on Thursdays, as an antidote to government and corporate propaganda on the most cutting-edge world and national topics. Distinguished guests are regularly featured to provide commentary and analysis impossible through the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation and what Project Censored calls junk food news. The Progressive Radio News Hour airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm gonna buy you out, and there is little doubt that I'm gonna make a lot of money.
Awareness of the problem
is gonna burst. This
price high.
Where everybody's maximum.
Oops alert. That CD has been played too much. It is now jumping. It will have to be retired. The home of CDs that have jumped too much. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm back here with News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.com. You've been listening to some songs from the soundtrack of my documentary In Debt We Trust that came out in 2006. Warning of a credit crunch. Warning of a meltdown, warning of a breakdown in our economy. I was greeted then with accusation. I was an alarmist and a doom and gloomer, didn't know what I was talking about. Well, in the end, unfortunately, I did, and we're all living with those consequences, not of our creation, but of the fact that the system has melted down and how serious it all is. We're going to take up with Aaron Crown a little bit later, because Aaron is monitoring monitors all of this on the indispensable ml-implode.com website, which you've got to check out if you haven't already. Okay, back to Justin Krebs. And Justin, what is the tank? I actually have been there, so I sort of know the answer, but tell the audience.
The Tank is a nonprofit venue for performing and visual arts that really connects with a lot of what you were saying before that you liked about showing films and almost micro cinemas. The Tank, whether it's film, theater, comedy, dance, music, mixed media, public affairs events, creates an environment where you don't only come, sit down, lights go off, you see a show, lights go up, you leave, but where you're encouraged to discuss, to meet the artist, to talk about the work, to have a drink, and to form some community. It's all kept very low cost for audience. Artists, presenters do not pay to use the space. Instead, the Tank takes a share of the door. And after 7 years, the Tank continues to exist, which in the nonprofit world is its biggest achievement of all.
Absolutely.
And it's currently on 45th Street between 8th and 9th Avenues.
That's right, in
40 events a month.
Right in the theater district of New York City. And it's an interesting venue. I've actually been there to a discussion about economic issues, and it was pretty well attended. And the vibe was great. So if you check out the Tank, I'm sure they're online.
TankNYC.org.
There you go. You can find out more about what they're doing. I also noticed that you are involved with this Credo phone company, which I've heard about. Can you tell us more about it? I just don't know anything about it at all.
Absolutely. Credo Mobile, which grew out of a company called Working Assets, that some of your listeners might be familiar with, is a for-profit company with a social mission. They sell you your mobile phone service or your long-distance phone service, but a portion of your bill each month goes into a pool of money that gets donated to progressive nonprofit causes, causes that help the environment, reproductive health, international peace, causes that help independent media and free media. The principle is that everyone's going to be paying a phone bill anyway. Why not pool that money? Why not put our assets to work? Hence, Working Assets.
Can you do that with an iPhone, which you have signed a contract?
You cannot do it with the iPhone, just because the iPhone is proprietary to AT&T right now. But you can get a BlackBerry, you can get an Android phone on Credo, and they will buy out your contract if you're with Verizon or AT&T or one of the other big companies. Those companies all give to conservative anti-consumer causes, and they give to conservative...
Including Apple?
Apple probably is a mix. I don't know as well, but if you're on an iPhone, then you're on the AT&T network, and they do. And so Credo tries to give you an alternative. It essentially creates another market. I no longer work with Credo. I've worked with them on projects in the past, but I am speaking to you right now from a Credo mobile phone. So you know that these things exist, and they're not just tin cans tied together with string.
Yeah, you're actually getting through here clearly. Pretty amazing, huh, Sherry?
Yeah.
We certainly want to touch all these bases. And your bio also, I noticed that you published Grounds for Play, a history of playgrounds in New York City, even though you're not from New York City originally. However, I wonder if you covered the playground on Van Cortlandt Park South in the Bronx, where I broke my arm at age 13, because I want to expose that playground. It didn't have that soft, rubbery stuff that now one finds in playgrounds. Then it
was
just
the new rubber grounds you can throw yourself down on and not get
right,
hurt.
Right.
That history came out in 2002. If only it had come out a few years later, we could have had a user-generated, content-filled website where people could have submitted their own stories and added to their history of the New York City playground.
Well, what I like, though, about what you're doing, in addition to the fact that you're doing all of these things and you're doing them well, which is another point of pride for you, and I think pride for those of us who see what you're doing, you're basically offering up ideas, basically encouraging people to come up with solutions to problems, not just kind of moan in our beer, but get inspired to do more things and to get more involved. I mean, there does seem to be a culture where the ideas that you can only you know, we need massive systemic, you know, change, structural change. It's so big you can't even wrap your head around it. And so nothing happens. We get into what I call the paralysis of analysis, you know, where we basically conclude before we even get going that nothing can happen. And so why bother? And, you know, it seems like a lot of the ideas, and I like it as give us a few, you know, give us all an idea that ideas are cool. You know, you come up with ideas, you can make suggestions. I mean, I'm on this station, which didn't exist, you know, a year ago, was basically ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, started with an idea. You know, here was a guy who's had a radio show for many, many years, and Gary Knoll, who was a very popular broadcaster on WBAI until he ran afoul of the political correctness, I guess, that rules there at times. And although it's, you know, it still has some great programming, but Gary set out on his own, did his own program, built a little studio here on Broadway in the 80s in New York. And lo and behold, you know, he's now got a ton of different people participating in this and hopefully listening to it. So ideas have consequences for good and evil.
I totally agree, and I think that that the media examples you give of how you can start a radio show, basically start a network, start an outlet, I think that's a story that's being well told. You look at bloggers who came out of nowhere to just express a little bit of expertise they had in some field and now become very trusted voices. Not everyone is going to start their own radio show or start their own blog, but there are things that anyone can do. I was just in Indianapolis, and there was a woman who was talking really excitedly about the work they're doing in the Near East End, a neighborhood of Indianapolis, where they're working on community gardens. They're building their first, they're building a new charter school. I know everyone has mixed feelings about charter schools, but this charter school is going to be focused on sustainability issues. They're actively hands-on in the development issues in their neighborhood. And you hear what they're creating there, and you say, okay, if that could work there, they're going to become a model for other neighborhoods around Indianapolis. That could then become a model for other planning on a citywide or a statewide level. And that's where change can really exist.
Right. In other words, we can, you know, think globally and act locally. We can actually come up with ideas and put them into practice, and sometimes they really catch on. Sometimes they don't.
And that's honestly how Drinking Liberally caught on. We were just at our own little drinking club, and then other people around the country started saying, hey, we also feel kind of alienated and kind of alone. We also want to do something more than shout at our computer screens. And now there are a couple hundred chapters around the country because people were tied into that idea. You know, when I hear the stories from the folks in Idaho Falls and Des Moines, Iowa, and all around the country, they are giving examples of how they can bring their liberal values even into the most conservative communities. And if they can do it in the most conservative communities, then we can do it in the most liberal communities like New York City.
Okay, so let's...
Justin, I have a quick question. How does one start a Drinking Liberally, just briefly?
Absolutely. You can, if you want to start a Drinking Liberally happy hour or a Screening Liberally movie club or any of the other programs, you can just email info@livingliberally.org or go to livingliberally.org, the website, and learn more about the programs. Free of charge, we'll help you get oriented, get you on the website. And then how you take it in your community is up to you.
Okay, well, here we are on the PRN yakking liberally, although sometimes we go beyond the restraints of liberalism into the spaced-out world of radicalism. We even hear from libertarians like Aaron Crown and others. This is not, you know, a kind of a one, you know, kind of a trick pony here. We're open to all ideas, and we're interested in yours as well. 888-874-4888. Justin Krebs, thank you so much. His book again, tell it to us again, and give us your website again. So
absolutely. 538 Ways to Live, Work, and Play Like a Liberal. You can find it at justinkrebs.com, at any online bookseller. And obviously the 539th way to live like a liberal is to listen to News Dissector every Thursday.
Hey, there you go.
Whoa.
And Sherry, thank you so much for connecting us, this program, with Justin. I hope we'll be able to check in with you on some sort of regular basis when there are things that you have to announce or things that we can share. I hope we can get together and do some plunder screenings. And I really appreciate your coming on, and Sherry, you coming on as well to talk about this with me and with our audience, because this is how the conversation starts. You know, we start talking and we never stop. Okay, thank you guys. All right.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Sherry. Good luck.
Okay. Change.
Aloha.
Change of subject right now from the hopeful and the positive to the more depressing, if you will. Aaron Crown joining us from Atlanta, ML-Implode website, implode.com websites, the family of websites that really are tracking what's happening in the various sectors of real estate and industry and banking and the like. And this is not a great week. You know, with both the unemployment figures coming out last week, day after we last spoke, and then, you know, all sorts of other stories about banks, about the Federal Reserve Bank, about, you know, fears in a way of a deeper collapse in Europe. Seems like you know, that we're not out of any woods yet. We may be going into the woods. Aaron, your take.
Yeah, there's a couple signal news events for this week that I think really drive that point home. One is, as most people recognize, the Fed had a meeting, came out with their big announcement, and they basically said that something that sounds pretty esoteric to most people, which is that they're going to take the proceeds from the mortgage bonds they've bought as they get paid off and buy treasury securities. And most people aren't quite sure what to make of that. It seems to be a nice little middle-of-the-road move. And the way I look at it is, you had the Fed for the last couple of years, since they've been doing this purchase of bonds to prop up the market that they call quantitative easing. They've been saying, oh, we have, you know, we'll have no problem getting out of it. We've got a plan. You know, we'll be able to extract ourselves from this when everything gets better soon. And that's basically been the party line. Well, with the announcement this week, all of a sudden they're basically not doing that. They're saying, well, you know, we can't get out of this. We have to stay in it. We're not going to do more of it because that would be too much of a signal to the markets that there's a problem. But at the same time, they're not going to extract themselves from it. So,
well,
the way I look at it basically is, the Fed is acknowledging that the market is now addicted to their intervention.
Right. Well, this is something very important for those out there who are still kind of yucking it up about the free market, when in fact this market is very managed and manipulated with government and quasi-government players all over the place. And the idea somehow that, you know, little mom and pop investors are really running American capitalism, I think you can forget that for now. But it seems like the stock market didn't react too well to the Fed's announcement, and it seems they seem to be more worried than ever.
Yeah, and I think there might be some acknowledgement there of what I said, which is that basically the market is still seriously broken and dependent on the Fed support. So the market may be acknowledging that, but at the same time, you know, that's just reading tea leaves. Who knows what's really going on behind the scenes? And as we discussed last week, the market has to face this continuous pressure now of those mom and pops and regular folks gradually extracting more and more money from the retail investment world. So the market is going to have to deal with that, I think, for the foreseeable future.
Now, also in the news this week were, you know, the travails of the Wells Fargo Bank, which settled for $200 million a claim by the SEC that it had been rigging various rules in terms of the monies that they were lending out, you know, extracting higher fees, confusing consumers with their ever-changing rules and regulations, you know, just check here. And you know, they paid off $200 million following, you know, a week ago when Countrywide did a $600 million settlement with the SEC. And earlier, Goldman Sachs did a $550 million settlement. So rather than, I guess, face prosecution, these banks are kind of coughing up some money to try to, you know, kind of get the government off their backs in part. So what I'm concerned about here is that when they find evidence, as the SEC apparently did, that Wells Fargo was, you know, in a sense, playing funny money games with their own
criminal,
with their own customers, criminal maneuvers, okay, to basically, you know, kind of deceive the customers and to squeeze them for more and more money. And they settle this with the government for $200 million. Do the people who were deceived, do the customers get any of that money? Are they being made whole in any way?
They're supposed to be able to get some fraction of the settlement. With large class actions like these, you don't see a lot of relief for the individuals. It's just divided too many ways, and the settlement is too small relative to the number of people harmed. So it's really more about supposedly penalizing Wells Fargo. But, most articles you find on that are pretty good about pointing out that Wells Fargo probably made much more money from this form of manipulation than the settlement's going to cost them.
Well, you know, I spoke to a banker about this, you know. He was really cynical about it, you know. His view said, well, lied, cheated, and stole. You know, they could have done that. I don't know. I haven't looked at it closely. But, he said, this is a really just a government shakedown, an extortion of money from the banks. In other words, his claim is that most of the money is going to basically feed the SEC or other regulatory agencies and the government budgets, and it is really not trickling down to the people who were ripped off in the first place. And he says it's a very deceptive and cruel. He even went so far as to say that Elliot Spitzer, when he was the attorney general in New York and was kind of the sheriff of Wall Street, as they called him, would go to a bank with a piece of paper, and on the piece of paper was a number that they had determined that this bank should pay. And you either paid it or they sued you. And it cost you probably a lot more money to defend against the losses. So he's basically saying that government plays extortionist games too. Is that true? Is this shocking?
Well, I think we have a lot of that effect, and maybe that's the predominant effect. I mean, the question on that thread, I would say, is where was the government 5 years ago? You know, 10 years ago, whenever we are. Any consumer you stopped on the street could have told you this was going on.
Right, and many did, actually. Many did and complained, and nothing much was done about it. So, you know, it's a very corrupted system is my only point. You know, yet and still at the same time, I was watching Charles Gasparino, kind of financial journalist, used to be with Newsweek, then he was with CNBC, now he's with Fox News, and he was on Fox News. So, of course, what he was doing, what everybody on Fox News does, promote Fox News. You know, about why everybody's scared of Fox News, why Fox News is so popular, why they're so brilliant, and all the rest of it. I mean, it seems like no discussion takes place on the factor without a healthy amount of self promotion and hype for Fox News. But nevertheless, what Gasparino was saying, he's saying, well, he was at CNBC. And he heard that Jeffrey Imhult, who was the head of GE, was basically kind of getting them to be less critical of the government. And he says now a lot of these CEOs are convinced that Obama is a socialist. What's the truth of this? I mean, are the CEOs turning on socialism, or are they just pissed off because of the federal the new reform bill, which requires them to do more accounting and be more transparent, etc.?
Well, I think they're trying to push back, basically, on reform that either is or might be and basically saying, you know, hey, we run the show here, so know your place. So, and I think that collectively the major CEOs of this country can do that. So that might be what we're seeing there, but your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of really monastic world, you know. I would say it's almost like, you know, back in the days of the Middle Ages, you know, where these CEOs meeting in their clubs and through their trade organizations, the Bilderbergers or the, you know, people in Davos and all the rest of this, you know, kind of meet to get the party line down and, you know, orchestrate it together. And here we have, you know, it seems to have a Republican, a Democratic camp. The New York Times has a big story about Bob Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary under Clinton, and who also was an advisor to Citigroup, now going to work with something called Centerview Partners, which is a fund managed by Democrats as well. And he's now an eminent Greece there, you know, trying to help them make connections, et cetera, and so forth. But it just seems to be so smarmy, you know, all of these people, greasers, you know, working benefit themselves and a small class of people, while most Americans are jobless or more and more people are homeless. And you know, we're in a situation where it looks like things could get a lot worse.
Yeah, I mean, I view it as essentially an aristocracy, which is exactly what this country is set up to avoid. It really is up to the people to stand up and prevent that from being the case.
Well, one way that people can do that, I believe, is to regularly visit ml-implode.com, your website, Aaron Crown, which is doing so much to really just track these stories, offer a range of viewpoints that are very, very provocative and compelling. So I would suggest that as a source for financial information. We're running out of time. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. We're going to be making this program available on podcast later today, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website. You can reach me at dissector@mediachannel.org. We're going out now with the theme song of my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. The voice you hear, Bernard Madoff.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold when Wall Street stepped into the fold. Congress paid off, workers laid off. Stanford, AIG, and Madoff. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets.